combat the spread of contagious diseases and epidemics. The provision of COVID-19 vaccine to Palestinians is the duty of the Israeli occupying forces. Israel bears full responsibility for the health and well-being of people under its occupation.
Palestinians have accused the Israeli regime of practicing medical apartheid against them and committing mass human rights violations. Experts say Tel Aviv must end its discriminatory policies and remove any barriers that may hinder Palestinians from accessing or enjoying health care.
Ban Human Rights Watch.
The statement by Human Rights Watch echoes the position of many international human rights organizations as it exposes the ugly face of the Israeli occupation. It also exposes the grave human rights violation by the Israeli regime, especially violating the health rights of Palestinians. Israel, as an occupying power, must meet its obligations under international laws and norms.
Human rights groups are expressing alarm over Israel's decision not to vaccinate more than 4.5 million Palestinians living in the occupied West Bank and the Gaza Strip, depriving them of their right to health care.
Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
Austria extends its third hard lockdown until the 7th of February, announcing a new requirement for everyone to use FFP2 or N95 masks in supermarkets and public transport, and extending the minimum distance rule from 1 to 2 meters. The announcement comes a day after thousands took to the streets of Vienna protesting the COVID restrictions. The right-wing FPÖ party, which supports the protests, expressed anger at the decision, warning that people would no longer understand the necessity for the measures and persist in civil disobedience. Officials maintained that they would do the right thing, notwithstanding how popular it will be.
The results of our consultations over the past few days make us anything but happy and also make us anything but popular.
Studies have now shown that the new virus variant first discovered in the UK has been in Austria earlier than was initially suspected, currently affecting around 10% of positive cases.
If the new variant replaces the current virus as the dominant strain, 5 times more cases of illness and death can be expected.
Austria's health minister says the country is currently in the most difficult phase of the pandemic and that the situation is very challenging, at least for the next 10 weeks till the end of March, when warmer weather and more vaccinations can help improve the situation. Around 600,000 people are expected to be vaccinated by then. The goal is to reach a 7-day incidence of 50 new infections per 100,000 people. That number is currently 130. But there's light at the end of the tunnel, Austria's Chancellor says. With the vaccination campaign underway, officials expect things to look more normal in April or at the latest in May. Homolesky, Vienna.
Did you really read all those books, or is it just to make an impression?
My sisters love those books. I really think you might like them. And I'm willing to be directed as well.
How much are you familiar with the books in the bookshelves of the Muslim libraries in the world?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. A warm welcome to you all, the dear audience. You're listening to the program Bookshelf on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And today, we are going to introduce a very nice book, a very interesting book, which is called Prayer, Worship, and Education. Well, this book, as the title suggests, deals with prayer's role in Islam, and as it is well said in the book, it puts the readers in a better acquaintance with the significance of the prayer and its marked influence on psychological, social, and ethical affairs, and also to make better understood the unique devotional role of prayer in comparison with other Islamic obligations. Well, in prayers, God's just watching over his worshipers, right? As they are asking him to do so, the good feeling falls between you and the Lord's as you pronounce the words, "Praise be to Allah, the Lord of the world, the most compassionate, the most merciful, master of the day of judgment." Even saying or hearing these words, well, gives every Muslim good vibes of support, love, and glorious future. When God is called as compassionate and merciful, we are reminded that we have someone to worship who is powerful, but also merciful. He is the one who can free us from the difficulties on our way. He shows us the direction to prosperity, guides us, and when we mistakenly commit a mistake, we admit it. He will forgive us. He is the master of judgment, the signs of lightning, and those who have committed haram acts, unlawful acts, without regression, will also face the outcomes or consequences of their action. And these signs bring out hope and light to the hearts of true Muslims. As you are calling him, and yes, he is listening. If it is not a close contact, what else can define it? But also looking back at the religion that brought us the sincere way of communication with the Lord, the rule of prayers has always been pointed out in Islam since Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and his holy family has said, "Prayer is the faithful's ladder to sublimity." To the times that our fathers have always pushed their dearest children to prevent delay in saying prayers or be careful of it, but some of us may not be fully aware of what can prayers do in our lives. This book is prepared for every Muslim around the world who seeks to know their religion better. Anyone who's eager to know what do prayers have to do with every aspect of Muslims' lives. How can simply standing and saying some Arabic sentences inspire you to be a better human being? It is all talked about in this book, Prayers, Worship, and Education. Alright? So, Islam, the religion of beauty and purity, has also beautiful compliments like prayers. The beauty of prayers and the becoming of a better person with a purer heart may not be ignored, even by the enemies. The ethical, psychological, behavioral, and social aspects will be talked about, in fact, in this book. So let's take a short break and we'll be back.
Every roadside, seaside, hillside, walkway, any place clean and green can be a place to pray. When I think of every path where I have ever trod, I laugh at all the crazy spots I stop to worship God.
There was the time next to the river, there was the time in the school hall, there was a stairwell in that building, there was that forest in the fall, the movie house corridor, the airplane kitchen in the sky. So many places, I'm sure there'll be more pieces of earth to testify.
All the earth is a place of prostration, every field and meadow, mountain, park, city, farm, plantation. Every roadside, seaside, hillside, walkway, any place clean and green can be a place to pray. When I think of every path where I have ever trod, I laugh at all the crazy spots I stop to worship.
You're listening to the program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad. Hosting this program, we were introducing the book Prayers, Worship, and Education. Well, have you ever noticed that during the day, right at moments that we are fighting our problems, what can the repetition of Allah's greater do with our tender hearts? Why do we feel better after the prayers? Most of us, at least. As the book makes us aware, these sentences act as miracles. We get calm, obedient, and ready to fight, since our God is greater than our enemies and problems. And that reminds us that we have a firm support, shoulders to cry on, and then stand up and keep going or doing. So this book elaborates also on the timing of prayers. Why is that so? What are the reasons behind saying prayers 5 times a day? Well, the book, referring to the Quran, Imam's quotes, or hadith and narrations, Let us know the reasons. The purification of prayers is also considered here. Our bodies that are ready to worship the unique Allah, and our souls that are supposed to be pure, they are what deal with our personality and behavior. Well, this school informs us of how to be a human. Qibla is the other factor involved, which is the symbol of unity in the Ummah. And also, one of the other things that has been discussed in this book is permissibility, right? This is what makes everyone aware that while saying prayers, you shouldn't drink usurped water and or stand in usurped places. A person should be just pure and everything should be halal or lawful, Islamically or ritually, for a Muslim to be ready for a lovely talk or communication with the creator of the worlds. The role of hearts. We just know that the hearts talk. They talk to God. So how can they be impure in such a meeting? The hearts should be present and pure to worship as the minds are focused. No distractions put distance in this journey. Muslims are required to be fully presented in their prayers to be connected to God for their own sakes. All right? So these are the things which have been discussed in this book. This book has been published by Al-Balagh Publication. All right? Well, we were talking about the book, Prayers, Worship, and Education. Let's take another break. You're listening to the program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program. Well, this is the part where we read an excerpt from the book that we introduced at every episode. And this episode, we were trying to introduce the book Prayers, Worship, and Education. Let me read the part that is entitled Presence of Heart and Sincerity. The Prophets, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, is quoted to have said, when one stands up to offer his prayer, he communes with his Lord. And he said, whoever makes light of prayer, he would never meet me at the spring of Kauthar, never by Allah. Prayer is quite worthless. If it is no more than automatic actions, verbal formulas, and soulless physical movements, prayers can never achieve its distinct goals if the worshipper is physically present but spiritually absent and thus removed from the object to which he offers his devotion. There must be a genuine presence to the point that one deeply realizes the value of the position of standing in front of Allah and the grandeur of the Creator he speaks to in his prayers. The soul, then, absorbs the meanings of prayer psychologically, spiritually, and morally, which equates to submission, love of Allah, desire for His reward, uprightness in behavior, and correctness in dealing with people, etc., etc. The soul is, in this way, affected by the ritual verbal formulas and actions. Every word pronounced by the worshipper and every action performed has a correspondingly deep effect on the human spirit. When man prostrates, he realizes the meaning of submission and respect for Allah's greatness and becomes aware of the falsity of human prides. When the individual raises his hands to supplicate for parents and his faithful brothers and sisters, that soul feels love, mercy, sympathy, and love of good towards others. Well, this was a very nice part, very interesting, and heart-touching. I hope you enjoyed this program. This program was coming to you from Iran, RIB English Radio. The program is Bookshelf, and the book that we introduced in this episode was Prayers, Worship, and Education. This is Muhammad Javad, signing off.
The Epic of 8-Year Holy Defense.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, we have said several times that the Iraqi dictator Saddam's main goal of initiating the 8-Year War and invading Iran was to overthrow the Islamic Republic system. He pursued other goals too, but he and his masters in Washington, Moscow, Tel Aviv, and Europe didn't reach any of their goals. For sure, the 8-year imposed war, or the holy defense, was one of the, if not the most important and most fateful periods of after the victory of the Islamic Revolution. It was also one of the most effective events in the region, as its consequences have remained in the region and the world after the lapse of over three decades of its end. That 8-year period left such deep impacts on Iran's military, cultural, economic, political, and social life. The 8-year war caused such a great deterrence power to Iran that today, the world powers, especially the United States, are scared of any aggression and evil thought against the Islamic Republic of Iran. Stay tuned for the last episode of this series. The 8-year war, apart from its hardships, destruction, and bitter events, left behind unique epics and unforgettable honors for the Iranian nation and the Islamic world. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, a few months before departure from the mortal world, issued a message, part of which reads, "Every day in the war, we had a blessing, which we have benefited from in all sins. We exported our revolution to the world. We proved our innocence and oppression of the invaders in the war. We removed masks from the face of deception of the world devourers. We recognized our friends and foes in the war. We came to the conclusion in the war that we have to stand on our own feet. We crushed the awe of the two Eastern and Western superpowers. We consolidated the roots of our fruitful revolution in the war. We in the war caused the sense of brotherhood and compatriotism to flourish in each of our people. We in the war showed to the people of the world, especially the regional people, that one can fight all powers and superpowers for long years. Our war resulted in the victory of Afghanistan. Our war will result in the victory of Palestine." Leader of the Islamic Revolution Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said on the support of the West and the East for Saddam during the eight-year war, "Throughout the Cold War era, there had been no issue in which the two world superpowers had such a unison so that both of them gave military equipment to one side. Since the Second World War till the era of the Holy Defense, you cannot find such special conditions. This was an exception that Saddam enjoyed both the unsparing economic, political, and even military support of the West to some extent, and besides, there were the vast military supports of the East. The whole army of Saddam was equipped with the weapons made by the Soviet Union and its East European satellite states, which were inside the Warsaw Pact and the Soviet superpower at that time. This was a strange thing. In this war, we were oppressed in the real sense of the word. Once, one of the officials was explaining that when we wanted to pass across the Soviet soil to import the barbed wire that we had bought from a country, but we were not allowed. It was one of the rare points of the contemporary era that a revolutionary country which had stood against the U.S. would face such restrictions by the Soviets. Dear listeners, the Eastern and Western blocs had come to the conclusion that any revolution with a religious nature would cause serious challenges, there being. Thus, they spared no effort to prevent it from thriving. Moreover, the fake Zionist regime of Israel and the backward Arab regimes in the region became very scared of the victory of the Islamic Revolution, which would put their illegitimate interests at stake. They were afraid of the revolution's turning into a role model for the regional nations, most of whom have not experienced the taste of popular rule and true democracy. Thus, both the West and the East threw their weight behind Saddam in all its all-out aggression against Iran, and that only 19 months after the victory of the Islamic Revolution. The eight-year war was imposed on Iran while the Islamic Republic system was still an infant and had not become stable. Furthermore, there were separatist groups here and there in the country. The Islamic Revolution Guards Corps and Islamic Revolution Committee forces, also with popular volunteer forces, had the mission of maintaining security in the country, and the army had just started tasting the sweet days of independence, while many of its remaining equipment were unusable, as the foreign, mainly American military advisors, had left the country. However, 1 year into the war, Saddam's war machine was stopped through the unmatched unity of army, IRGC, and Basij force, and formation of resistance units. By the end of the seventh year of war, Iran turned from defensive into offensive side in the war, in spite of all-out supports of the West and the East for Saddam. Saddam's supporters, especially the United States, seeing his successive failures in the war, intensified their support, and Washington directly entered the war in favor of Saddam in the waning month of the war. In such circumstances, Imam Khomeini, as the commander-in-chief of the armed forces, came to the conclusion that accepting the UN Security Council Resolution 598 was to the benefit of the Islamic Republic. The eight-year war was the only war in the history of Iran in which the entire soil of the country was liberated from occupation. Then, as the Imam had predicted, Saddam invaded Kuwait 2 years after the end of the eight-year war and seriously threatened the Arab regimes in the region. Therefore, these regimes expressed regret over their supports for Saddam during his war of aggression against Iran. The eight-year war caused the regional and trans-regional powers to recognize the Islamic Republic and understand that Iran had turned into a big regional power. So, they admitted Iran's power in the regional and even global equations. Thus, the Islamic Revolution went from strength to strength through the selfless steadfastness of its youth. Yet, the United States and its allies, or partners in crime, didn't stop their enmities against the Islamic Republic after the end of the war. Nevertheless, as the enemies have aggravated their hostilities, Iran has become more and more powerful and stable and has made bedazzling breakthroughs in various scientific and military spheres. In some of these areas, Iran ranks among the 10 countries in the world. To mention a few of them, Iran is among the 10 countries which enjoy the full cycle of nuclear fuel for peaceful purposes. It also has gained the capability of launching satellite to the orbit. The Islamic Republic stands among the few countries which have access to the know-how of nanotechnology and stem cells. Iran owes all this to the eight-year holy defense.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Today. The key to stability in West Asia has very different definitions than American and Persian dictionaries. Iran says stability can be maintained only by regional unity and secured by regional powers. The U.S. appears to see stability in omitting regional powers and sowing discord among neighbors. There's over 11,500 kilometers between the U.S. and Iran. Welcome to Iran Today. I'm Leila Faramarzi, bringing you the topic of stability and instability in the region of West Asia or the Middle East. To put it in U.S. terms, instability is synonymous with Iranian policy in the region. Now, how can that be, given two things? One, the fact that the region is Iran's own neighborhood, and two, recent events unfolding in America show anything but stability in the U.S. itself.
We're talking bearskins and horns in the capital as pro-Trump protesters attacked to overturn election results.
Let's hear what Mr. Parkayin has to say. He's our former ambassador and foreign ministry veteran.
Americans are now facing serious instability in their own country, but at the same time, they did not leave our region. This is because the U.S. has managed to remain a superpower throughout its history due to its presence in the Middle East and West Asia. Today, this active presence no longer exists, which is why Western experts themselves consider the absence of the United States in the region as a sign of its decline.
I've brought you to Parliament today for a quick chat with MPs on the topic of stability in the region, its defenders and destroyers.
The U.S. has a specific formula depending on the situation in every country to secure a foothold there, behaviors that are known by the whole world. Everyone knows that U.S. behaviors in a specific way in the Middle East, South America, Africa, and Southeast Asia, for example. You can see this country's behavior in the world. It is usually pursuing its own interests under the pretext of creating security in the world. That is, the cover of America's behavior is such that it portrays itself as a defender of the nations, but uses the excuse to safeguard its interests and exploit those nations behind the scenes. Iran is a vast country with a unique and ancient history. We have always been a pacifist.
I've heard advocates of U.S. foreign policy say things like, America dropped the bomb to put a stop to the war, referring to America nuking Hiroshima and Nagasaki in World War II, as if to say the bomb was meant for peace. It gives me confidence in my understanding that to the U.S., it's instability for stability, whereas Iran has been calling for peace and friendship for stability and safety.
They themselves destabilized the region. As is written in history, they started disintegrating Islamic countries. Their presence in the region is in an attempt to disintegrate great Islamic countries, including Iran, Turkey, Iraq, and Saudi Arabia, although some Arab countries are not mindful of this issue. They plan to disintegrate these countries to make them unable to defend themselves. They want to appear under the pretext of restoring security in the region and defending the regional nations, and at the same time plunder their wealth and resources.
Perhaps stability and security meant something else to the U.S. in its heyday of imperialism, when smaller countries were more cooperative. But today it means securing the stability of U.S. interests at any cost for others.
و سوریه و لبنان نیستیم، فقط هم ایران نیست. مسئله اصلی لزوم یا عدم لزوم بی‌ثباتی در این کشورها نیست. یعنی بی‌ثباتی مسلمه که باید بی‌ثباتی در این کشورها به وجود بیاد، بلکه چگونگی ایجاد بی‌ثباتی مورد نظره. بی‌ثباتی رو چجوری ایجاد؟ حالا یه وقت در یه جا با داعش، یه وقت با فتنه 88 و با امثال اینها و کارهایی که شما میبینید در منطقه دارن انجام میدن.
جیمی کارتر، the US president that lost Iran, although he did acknowledge later that Iran was never his to be lost, did lord this country as an island of stability. That was in 1977. Between 1972 and 77, the Shah or Iranian king splashed out on a defense build-up with petrodollars. The price of oil quadrupled in 1973, and he purchased more than $16 billion in arms from the U.S. in 5 years, on top of about $3 billion per year in bilateral civilian trade. As soon as 1979, events took a sharp turn. The Islamic Revolution happened, and as 2,500 years of monarchy were toppled, America's island of stability turned into an island of nightmares. It's not what the U.S. and other world powers expected, but it happened. Iranians had decided being an island of stability was no compliment if the country couldn't decide its own fate without foreign interference.
Oil was nationalized before the revolution. If the nation had waited a little, would things have changed, or would Iran carry on with its dependence on the West?
Developments took place, such as a national oil movement during the time of Dr. Mossadegh and Ayatollah Kashani, and a lot of effort was made and the people supported it. But then, when the Americans came back to power and brought back the Shah, they ousted Mossadegh, and in fact, the oil nationalization movement failed. Following that, not only did we remain dependent on the United States, but the Zionist regime also took oil from Iran. The war machine of the Zionist regime was working with Iranian oil. So was South Africa's. That is, the South African war machine against the blacks was also powered by Iranian oil.
A main revolutionary motto of the Iranians was independence. Why did they even feel a vacuum of independence, I asked.
Well, a lack of independence was very tangible before the victory of the Islamic Revolution. The reason being that Reza Shah, Mohammad Reza's father, was brought to power by the British. There is no doubt about it. During the reign of Reza Shah, the whole country depended on three great powers, the British, the French, and the Russian, which divided the country into the north and the south. Russia led Iran's oil in the north, while southern oil was controlled by Britain. France was also taking advantage of Iran.
Having suffered 8 years of an imposed war in isolation, referring to the Iraq-Iran War of the 1980s, Iran has built up its defense industry. U.S. interference and involvement it deems a no-no, an outlook that outgoing U.S. President Trump has justified by making it a habit to go back on deals, namely the JCPOA or Iran nuclear deal.
The reports from the US or European forums are mainly focused on our missiles. They always speak about our missiles, and they think that our defense power is limited to our missiles. Now, missiles is only one sector of our defense programs. We're as active in other sectors as we are in the missile sector. For example, ground defense, maritime defense, and underground defense. We're also working on other systems. We see how the world is watching us. But we never neglect our defense capability.
Not to go off on a tangent, U.S. interference, even presence, has been a military presence and intervention. To balance power in the region, America has not settled for having its own boots on the ground even, but has created proxies. Its proxies are not your average militia. Rather, America has admittedly created or supported the most savage terror groups operating in the name of Islam. Yet it fights them, selectively. I say selectively because it, the U.S., has acted vengefully against Iran, Syria, and Iraq since their successful fight against Daesh, or ISIS. Just before the General Soleimani assassination last year, Iran's leader accused the U.S. of creating Daesh and saying, the U.S. actions in Syria and Iraq were intended to take revenge on the PMU for defeating ISIS, or Daesh. PMU stands for Popular Mobilization Units, an Iraqi state-sponsored umbrella organization. Now, why does the U.S. see Iran a front to its foreign policy?
After all, Americans have always sought to impose themselves on nations and governments through bullying, to pass themselves off as a superpower. The Islamic Revolution has emerged with the slogan of freedom of all nations of the world, but they don't want this slogan to spread. 4 decades after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, we have been able to awaken many of the world's nations with our slogans of seeking justice and freedom. With our own cultural revolution, America doesn't want the awakenings in the oppressed nations.
U.S. propaganda is riddled with controversy. In spite of its sporadic admissions to the contrary, the United States still ostensibly claims it is seeking stability in the world. It claims it is Iran and allies that are seeking terrorism and reducing stability. But history reflects the truth like a mirror. Iran has a no-first-strike policy. It has waged no wars in over 200 years. That's about as long as the U.S.'s whole lifespan, nearly all of which has been spent on war. And now it looks on the verge of a second civil war.
When we review the US culture over the last 200 to 300 years, we see that wherever the US has stepped in South America, in Vietnam, in Africa, there's been war, bloodletting, massacre, and violation of human rights. That has caused insecurity. Therefore, I know no positive example of the US presence in the world to have brought security.
It's understandable. While the traveler will muddy waters to catch his fish, residents would opt for protecting their waters for sanitation and sustainable use. Even with selfish intentions, Iran's interests lie in lack of instability in the region. To establish and maintain all-round relations, especially trade relations with neighboring states, Iran needs the region secure, and it has done something about it, or in some cases made recommendations for sustainable stability and security in West Asia or the Middle East. Iran has constantly been in the spotlight for its considerable influence in the five states, Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan, and Yemen. And also, the Palestinian issue is of great consequence to Iran, both geostrategically and for humanitarian reasons. Before getting into each of our five states separately, I'd like to invite you to a quick media review to see what other outlets have to say. Here's how the topic of terror and instability, stability versus instability, looks in other outlets, beginning with China Daily. U.S. duplicity on terrorism, condemnable. Terrorism is the common enemy of all humans, and terrorists have caused great harm to all countries and people around the world. So all countries should treat terrorism and terrorists as potent threats. However, Washington often reacts fiercely to terrorist attacks in the U.S. or its ally countries and stands united with them. Yet when terrorists launch attacks in countries which the U.S. sees as rivals or competitors, it remains indifferent and even tries to use so-called ethnic and or religious problems in these countries to dilute the issue or give it a political twist. Therefore, it is time for the U.S. to abandon double standards on terrorism and stop supporting its favored terror groups. Otherwise, it would also get burned by the fire it has been fanning. We've something from Tehran Times quoting an Indian professor, Ashok Swain, who says the U.S. role in the Middle East or West Asia has never been constructive. Swain, a professor of peace and conflict research at the Department of Peace and Conflict Research from Uppsala University, believes Washington has been seeking its own interests in the region. Its interest has never been for the Middle East's security and development, but for its own security and development. The Indian professor says it will not only be difficult, but in many cases impossible for the Biden administration to bring back the mask of a fair adjudicator, which the USA has been wearing for decades. Fars News quotes Iran's top security official, who underlines the necessity of a U.S. pullout from the region. The Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, SNSC, Ali Shamkhani, stressed that the withdrawal of American forces from the regional states is a necessity. The U.S. has intensified its measures to foment insecurity in West Asia in the past year, and the climax of this behavior was the cowardly assassination of anti-terrorism commanders General Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. Shamkhani continued, the Islamic Republic of Iran is determined to take a harsh revenge on the masterminds and perpetrators of this historical crime to stop the U.S. and its agents' continued terrorist and anti-security actions, which stir tension in the region and force them to leave the region. And that's what was on offer from other media outlets. Stay with me, for there's more to come. Iran's interest in creating stability in the region. To demonstrate that by example, let's take a look at Iran's stance towards each of five states. In Iraq, Iran seeks stability because it has common economic, security, religious, cultural, and other interests in this country. The U.S. presence in Iraq has killed hundreds of thousands of people so far, And so, in Iran's view, a U.S. presence will not bring peace here on out either. A warring U.S. presence in Iraq began in 2003. And if terror can be separated from invading a country, given the U.S. is at war in the Middle East at large, but says it's fighting its pet terror groups here, why did it assassinate General Soleimani? Soleimani was Iran's frontman against Daesh. Following the Daesh or ISIS surge into northern Iraq over 5 years ago, Iran moved swiftly by arming Iraqi Kurdish fighters and supporting Baghdad with military advisors. It also provided training for Shia militias in a counteroffensive against Daesh. By fighting the relentless terror group, it kept them off European borders even. Had it not been for Iran's confrontation with Daesh, that bloodthirsty group would probably have taken over Baghdad, and its supporters, the United States and Saudi Arabia, would have just continued to hesitate in confronting it.
What the Islamic Republic of Iran wants is to establish security in the Gulf of Oman, the Strait of Hormuz, and the Persian Gulf. Insecurity will benefit nobody. Naturally, we would never like our neighbor's home to be set on fire, because even if the fire does not spread, the smoke will reach us. That's why we prefer the region to be secure and calm. However, hegemonic nations prefer to create insecurity in the region.
Similarly, in Syria, Iran seeks peace and security partly by joining the fight against ruthless terrorist groups. Iran's stance is to stand by the Syrian people, the Aleppo liberation, and establishing a truce as key to establishing peace and stability in Syria.
Iran maintains influence in the region because it makes its own decisions and chooses its own friends. There are two types of influence, legitimate and illegitimate. Legitimate influence is when a country, one of Iran's neighbors or a more distant one, invites us to help it counter terrorism. For example, Syria and Iraq invited us. We do not intend to impose our views on these countries and interfere in the internal affairs of these countries. But because they wanted us to help them and because we have a common security risk, we go ahead and help them as an advisor.
As for Palestine, Iran seeks a peaceful solution to the Palestinian issue, but believes it will not be resolved the way the United States and Israel have in mind, not by expanding illegal Jewish settlements on Palestinian land, by consensus with others, that is. Resistance and referendum is the only viable solution to the Palestinian issue, according to Iran. That is to say, all original Palestinians of any faith displaced anywhere in the world must themselves decide their own fate by referendum. In Afghanistan, Iran seeks stability because with an insecure Afghanistan, the influx of refugees into Iran will increase. Also, drug trafficking towards this country will increase.
They came to Afghanistan 18 years ago, saying they wanted to uproot terrorism. But the result today is a tenfold, even 100-fold increase in drug production, growing insecurity in Afghanistan, migration of Afghans to Europe, Iran, and Pakistan. They said they wanted to remove Saddam because of chemical arms, which were never unearthed. Today, the Americans themselves, under the pretext of fighting Daesh, have triggered chaos in the entire region.
Iran believes intra-Afghan talks can lead to the process of establishing peace and stability with no need for third parties to interfere in the process. Abdul Ghafur Leval, the Afghan ambassador to Iran, expressed gratitude to this country for its support of the Afghan peace process, establishment of the legitimate government in that country, and hosting Afghan migrants for several decades. Iran's regional presence and intervention is understood, but one country raises eyebrows. I asked for justification to Iran's cooperation in Yemen.
As stated in its constitution, the Islamic Republic of Iran must defend the oppressed in the world. But this defense is legitimate, that is, at the request of those countries. The Yemenis also got help from us. We do not have a military presence in Yemen, but we have an advisory presence. We will help the Yemenis as much as we can and defend the rights of the Yemeni people in the international arena.
Iran calls for an end to Saudi and allied attacks on Yemen.
and for Yemenis to decide their own destiny. In doing so, Iran submitted a 4-point Yemen peace plan to the United Nations. The plan announced by Foreign Minister Zarif in 2015 calls for an immediate ceasefire and an end of all foreign military attacks, humanitarian assistance, and a resumption of broad national dialogue and establishment of an inclusive national unity government. The international community will no doubt have to get more effectively involved, as instability has been allowing terrorist groups to gain a foothold in Yemen. I asked, why does the U.S. pursue endless conflict everywhere, especially in West Asia?
Theorists have always said that seizing control of the Middle East is the necessary step towards world domination. One reason is the region's geographical situation that is located on the crossway of three continents. The second reason is the cultural situation. The region is where prophets had their revelations and heavenly books descended. The third and the most important reason is that 60% of the world's energy is supplied from this region. These unique characteristics have made this region a target for great world powers and colonialists, from the United States to Britain and others.
To attempt the more everyday aspects of life and Iran's interest in its regional market. Iran's economy is based on industry and agriculture, and its service sector has been answering its domestic needs because of quality manpower. Now there's an overflow to be exported to regional states, but that requires stability and security in the neighborhood. The U.S. presence is a problem, as are its sanctions. It constantly imposes sanctions on Iran so that other states can't connect to Iranian goods and services. And then the U.S. imposes its own goods and services on those countries. So you can see, it's a constant chain of problems for this country.
If only insecurity would stop at harming the mutual benefits reaped from trade. Lives are being lost and countries are suffering upheaval. And so, Iran seeks U.S. withdrawal from the entire region because it agrees and believes that a U.S. presence will only increase insecurity and provoking public sentiment. It was in May 2020 that the Iranian President Rouhani pointed to problems faced by countries in the region, calling for their cooperation to overcome those problems, which have remained the coronavirus and falling oil prices, security problems, and most importantly, U.S. interference in these countries. His focus was on Iraq at the time. He expressed satisfaction that the political process in Iraq had reached a point when all Iraqi groups and tribes were alongside each other.
That's it for today. Thanks for watching from the whole team. Do return to the box at the same times next week and each week after, as you never know what's on. And don't forget to leave your comments and topic requests. Bye for now.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Nasir Rafi'i. Please stay tuned.
الانسان همانا انسان خلق الانسان من عجل آیه صحیحش اینه خلق الانسان من عجل.
In ayah 37 of Surah Al-Anbiya in the Holy Quran we read, man is a creature of haste. However, in continuation of the same ayah we read, so do not ask me to hasten. Now, one might ask, isn't here in this verse a contradiction? From one side, human is created from haste, and from the other side, humans are asked not to hasten. The main question here is, how a human who is created out of haste must not hasten in his actions? The best answer to this doubt is that Allah has created humans with haste and many attributes like anger or sexual desire, so that He uses them in the positive way. For instance, if there was no haste, no one would try to overtake others in doing good deeds or helping others with their needs. Thus, haste, like any other thing, can be used in both positive and negative ways. It is like a knife with which one can peel the fruit skin or hurt others. Or it's like a hammer in the hands of a blacksmith who beats the iron to make something out of it. The very sense of haste is exactly like this. It is necessary for humans. However, haste has its own timing, and we are not allowed to hasten in all our efforts. Thank you very much, dear listeners of iRib English Radio, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Nasir Rafi'i. To find out more about this program and our other programs, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care, and goodbye.
IRIB English Radio.